Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Hey, hey, hey there. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, whenever you happen to be listening to our podcast. We welcome you and we are really glad to have you on board. If you are listening today on the first day of release of this, you will know it is Halloween. So happy spooks and goblins and zombies and all sorts of mystic, magical stuff, whatever you happen to be into. Today also, just happened this morning, the House of Representatives did formally pass a resolution to start the process of impeachment for Donald Trump. That happened today. We are going to talk about that on our broadcast today. We are also going to be talking about a case in Texas where this was a custody case. The parents have been fighting for 2 years for custody of several kids. One of the children is a transgender girl. The father in the custody case is not supportive of his child's transgender status. And the mom is fighting not for full custody, but fighting for joint custody, but for the father to essentially be supportive of their child, and which the mom is a pediatrician and she knows that to do otherwise can be incredibly detrimental to their child's mental health and up the rate of potential suicide attempts that a transgender child tends to do when they are not supported by their parents. So that is what is happening in the case. What has happened as a result of the case, though, is incredible vitriol on the part of a group of conservatives in Texas, including Ted Cruz, including, not from Texas, but nipping his nose in anyway, Donald Trump Jr., both of which who have accused the mom of, quote-unquote, child abuse. And there are many voices on the conservative side that are pushing to declare any parents that are working with their children and supporting their children in this as committing child abuse. So we're going to talk about that, where that case stands, and those similar efforts that are going on, as well as I said, the impeachment proceedings that happened today. So it is my pleasure to welcome on board co-host Brody Levesque. Good morning, Brody. How are you?
Yeah, good afternoon, good morning, and happy Halloween, Rob. And to our listeners out there who celebrate, happy Halloween to all of you. Please be safe. And a little public service announcement here on behalf of the American Autistic Society and two or three people who are personally very close to me. If you all are out there and you're either handing out candy or you're getting candy and you're just enjoying yourself on Halloween, if you see a young child with a blue pumpkin container that they're collecting their treats in, be extra nice because that designates the child as autistic, and it would be greatly appreciated just if you'd be a little bit extra nice to that kid, maybe slip a couple extra pieces of candy in there. But be aware, the blue buckets are denoting the fact that they're autistic. On that note, House Resolution 660 was the resolution to push forward officially an impeachment inquiry into the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. The vote came down to a party line, as expected. The Democrats voted 232 to a complete Republican minority of 196 against. So the yeas got it with 232. The hearings and the impeachment process will, in fact, now move forward It essentially also takes away a Republican talking point that because they didn't have it officially declared an impeachment inquiry, it wasn't the real deal. This is a talking point that Trump's personal attorneys were using. Republican members of the House, including the minority leader, Kevin McCarthy of California, was constantly banging away at. So these are the things that, you know, really will kind of evaporate into the wind now because it's official. On a footnote to the vote on House Resolution 660, there were two Democrats that voted against the resolution of the impeachment inquiry, Representatives Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey and Representative Colin Peterson of Minnesota. These are Democrats who voted no, and I'm sure we'll be hearing something about that probably in the not-too-distant future. Also happening today,
concurrent with that vote in the House.
On those two gentlemen,
They both represent districts that went for Trump, and so they are essentially reflecting, I'm sure, in their opinion, their constituencies. I guess I'm not as baffled by them, although it is important to note that there were seven such representatives on the Democratic side that represented Trump districts, and Nancy Pelosi was able to convince five of them to go with the majority. So, you know, it's kind of a win for her that there were only two, not just that the two did break ranks. I guess I'm a little bit baffled why the Republican bloc was so solid. I would think that some of them would have wanted to go on record of wanting to look into this and be essentially on, you know, a fair side of history, you know, but it seems like it turned very political and power grab oriented. What were your thoughts on that?
It went completely partisan. It was 100% partisan. In the debate period leading up to the vote on House Resolution 660, they compared the resolution and the entire impeachment inquiry process to Soviet-style tactics. These are the Republican talking points. They pretty much unified. Most of the folks that, you know, sit in my chair as an editor and as a pundit are looking at it in one way only. It's no longer the Republican Party. It's now the Trump Party. And everybody seems to be kowtowing to the president and following him behind him. Insofar as the fact is the president had, as reported by Dana Basher with CNN earlier this morning, Trump is basically threatening Republican senators that he'll yank money away from them if they, get involved in the trial and, you know, vote to convict him. So it's obviously a desperate ploy on the part of the White House, but at the same time, we're seeing this permeate through the entire Republican establishment. I think the other part of this, Rob, is that the Republicans have become so drunk on political partisan power because they've held the upper hand, really, if you consider a big, huge chunk of time from 1994 forward, a majority of the time the Republicans have held one or both houses. And they've just absolutely positioned themselves in such a way as, you know, there is no bipartisanship. That's a joke. It's their way or the highway. And the politics of the country itself have gotten so divisive that it's just become an echo chamber, quite frankly, on both sides. I'm not going to let the Democrats off the hook either, but it really has become such a divisive thing. But I think today's vote actually illustrated that again, that that's how toxic the American political process has now become. I was listening in on conversations on C-SPAN, and as you know, they do the call-in thing, and virtually every Republican was parroting every point that we've heard congressional leadership put out there, that we've heard the White House put out there. It's a witch hunt. You know, he didn't do anything wrong. There was no quid pro quo. You know, why was, you know, Biden's son, blah, blah, blah. It, it, it virtually is the entire soaking period, and they're overlooking the fact that real, you know, problematic things happened with this president in the way that he dealt with the Ukrainian leader. You know, you strip away the veneer of everything else, including the Mueller report and all the other nonsense. You go right to the heart of the issue on Ukraine alone, and especially now with we've got people like Colonel Vindman coming and testifying to this fact. Yeah, he strong-armed the Ukrainian leader to investigate two of his political rivals. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's a no, you know. But the Republicans are, I think, in many ways so afraid of losing power that they are desperate, and they really, truly believe that if they don't come in behind the president, that's it. The irony, for those of us looking at it, is they've almost completely destroyed their party. The core support of Trump isn't that large to begin with, and support from even the Republicans themselves has now slipped below the 48% mark. And again, this is based on polling, and everybody knows that polling is not exact science, but at the same time, it's showing the tenor of it. So today's vote,
right,
the party line, wasn't a surprise, Rob, at all. You know,
it just seems that it's hard to look at them and trust them as public servants that they're there to maintain, you know, rule of law. It is making it look much more free for all and ethicless. I mean, just is, you know, all standards are of decorum and appropriateness, let alone care about the welfare of the country, seem to be thrown out the window. And I mean, in a much more, and you know, you can be cynical that, you know, that people in power are always looking for their pet agendas anyway, and et cetera, but it just seems to be being done on a much more blatant stage than ever before.
And it has gotten pretty bad in terms of partisanship and some of the other things. Today, prior to the two floor votes on Resolution 660, Representative Katie Hill, who's a Democrat from California, delivered her farewell address to Congress, and she resigned, as she put it, rather than having, quote, revenge porn stories and nude photos taken without her consent. Continue to leak out day by day by Republican operatives. And you contrast her resignation from Congress over that to the fact that Representative Duncan Hunter, also from California, although albeit a little south of where Representative Hill is, he's got five affairs that he used campaign money to finance. He's been indicted, and he's still in Congress. So you've got the ultimate in hypocrisy. I'm not even going into the obvious, which is, women are still saddled second-class citizens when it comes down to the men, especially in things like this. This is ridiculous.
Right.
Okay, but the fact that if you just go into Republican partisan politics, okay, you know, if that had been a Democrat, Duncan Hunter, okay, his
bar woman
bounced out of Congress, you know, that would have been the end of it, right?
Right.
So,
right.
This is
right.
Kind of, and this absolutely reflects, I think, more than anything else, the toxicity of exactly what's going on in terms of how politics are being handled nationally. And of course, as you know, that kind of filters down into a state level. But when you're talking Congress, you know, both houses, this is exactly where it's at. One of the things that a friend of our show, he's a well-known activist. He's one of the founders of the DC chapter of Gays Against Guns. He's a longtime activist against conversion therapy, and he's a marriage equality activist, John Becker. You know, one of the things that John pointed out is he said this in a post on his Facebook personal page earlier this morning. The Republican Party is gone, y'all. Gone. I know it's something we've all known for a long time, but take a moment today on the occasion of this historic impeachment vote to ponder This fact, one of America's two major political parties, has devolved into a fanatical, reality-denying, evidence-immune, dear-leader-style, authoritarian fascist cult with slavish and unwavering devotion to an unhinged, deranged career criminal who has no loyalty to any person, any country, or any entity but himself. And then, skipping down, then John says, the GOP is utterly, morally bankrupt and completely irredeemable. They would circle the wagons around Satan himself if he promised to give tax breaks to the wealthy, take away health care from poor people, punish black and brown and queer people, rob women of their bodily autonomy, and stack the courts. And then he ends. Their party must be burnt to the ground so that something can be built on the ashes that isn't a cancer on and a threat to the United States. And the interesting thing about John's statement is I have heard that similar sentiment expressed over and over and over, and especially after today's vote on House Resolution 660. So John's not the only one saying it. And here's the irony for you, Rob. Some of the people I'm hearing that from are longtime Republican Party operatives and longtime Republican Party donors. They know.
Yeah, no, that no, it's hard to empathize because it is the principles the Republican Party has always stood for are the ones that are the most weakened by their behavior. I mean, you know, again, when I was talking about rule of law and that kind of protectionism of the country. The people who and I kind of get this actually from the Trump perspective because he comes from business and in the corporate world, first of all, in the corporate world, leaders are dictators. They're not elected mm-hmm. by the company that they are ruling. They are the dictator of that company. And mm-hmm. second of all, in the corporate world, when you look at the landscape, the competitors and the other corporate partners that they may have, today's partners are tomorrow's competitors and vice versa. And Trump plays mm-hmm. it that way in that he gets in bed with the people who have always been our adversaries and shuns the people who have always been our allies. And he does it in not a sensical way. And a lot of these loyalties are ones that the Republican Party have been more adamant about than anybody in the past. But because mm-hmm. Trump's doing it, now all of a sudden they're Russia friendly. And, it's just, it's confusing, perplexing, and actually terrifying on a lot of levels.
It is.
But I want to switch. Yeah. Any other news going on besides the impeachment?
Yeah, I have.
What happens next?
I have one more thing to go after that. But okay, what happens next? So we have essentially six extremely powerful House committees, including Representative Adam Schiff of California's Intelligence Committee, and now we're going to be seeing public hearings. This is what the Republicans are demanding. So. For those of us that are old enough to remember Watergate hearings or read about it in school, we will probably be seeing actual hearings held on each aspect of everything being brought forward. The difference is I think that we're going to see a moved up timetable on this because Democratic leadership really does want to try and get this to the Senate before the end of the year. Now, whether or not Speaker Pelosi is going to be able to hold a vote and actually impeach the president by year's end right now is being debated. I should footnote that she only needs 218 votes to impeach the president. And if today's vote is any indication where she was, well over what she needed, 232, I think we can probably count on President Trump being impeached. So the next process is there's going to be more testimony. We're going to see pick up in time. We're going to also see House managers start dealing directly with the president's attorneys, which was part of the resolution. It will be a lot more transparent of a process. I think that the closed hearings, such as what the Intelligence Committee were holding this last week, will probably cease. And now I think we'll probably see a lot more openness in terms of what's out there. Now, whether or not that does damage to the president's position is anybody's guess. I think principally and primarily because he still has a significant support base. Now, I think one of the things that will probably change attitudes is once some of this other information comes out. However, you know, that may or may not be a deciding factor. We saw that in some other hearings on some important issues, such as the Kavanaugh confirmation hearing process. So, you know, it's kind of a, you know, you flip the coin up and you call heads or tails, and then you wait to see which one it lands on.
Right.
It can't possibly help him
if, you know, every day is new headlines of things being said that are, you know, we've heard or have been said in private are now being said publicly. I mean, there's nothing that has come out so far that is in his favor, to my knowledge.
No, actually, there hasn't been. The White House talking points and White House positions continue to get shot down when the facts become available. So, no.
Right.
It's a lot of this is going to be, I think, when you're looking at it, in addition to the action by Congress, but you're also looking at what we call the court of public opinion. Now, whether or not that will be enough to sway the Senate is really where it counts. I think the House impeaching this guy is a foregone conclusion. She's got what it'll take to do it. The big question mark is, you know, the Senate itself. Right now, based on the numbers that we're hearing from sources on the Hill, impeaching the president, they're still shy about roughly 15 or 16 senators. So I think a lot of this is going to take, you know, something drastic enough to nudge the meter over on the Senate side. And again, you know, the president is doing a full court press, as Dana Bash related, and Politico actually did an article today in terms of, you know, him threatening money for reelection campaign. So, you know, the White House is doing a full court press. Whether or not some of those senators are going to waver, and especially ones that are in districts that are being targeted by the Democrats heavily, that are, could possibly flip, I think a lot has to do with that. And maybe the court of public opinion could play a role in that. It's very hard to say.
Yeah. This is a case, though, of exactly why this is so mind-numbing, is that this behavior, which is basically to intimidate the Senate, is exactly that witness suppression behavior that is around all of this. I mean, it's that that thuggery, unethical, you know, activity that he's undertaken already. I mean, it just, it's very hard to look at him and not believe that he isn't as guilty, if not guiltier, than anything that he's charged with or that is suggested.
Yeah, that's true. The other thing that we need to put on folks' radar screens before we go into the Texas case, and it's kind of related. On Capitol Hill this week, we have a small group of so-called ex-gay and formerly transgender people who are lobbying Congress against two bills that, given the current president of the United States administration, won't become law anytime soon. But what they're doing, which is more damaging, is they're engaging in a disinformation campaign to belies the actual facts of it. The two bills, as related by my colleagues at NBC News, are the Equality Act and the Therapeutic Fraud Prevention Act. Now, the first one would expand the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to ensure that protections for LGBTQ people in areas such as housing, credit, banking, employment, public accommodations, and more would be covered. That's kind of important given the fact that the United States Supreme Court literally just heard two cases that would be directly addressed congressionally, legislatively, by an Equality Act should it pass. The second bill is the Therapeutic Fraud Prevention Act. This one is designed to ban harmful and dangerous conversion therapy, which is basically a pseudoscience that purports to change a person's sexual orientation or actual gender identity. The thing that was noted by one of the people that's up on the hill was that I'm quoting, "I live in Portland, Oregon, and I don't see the discrimination that LGBT people talk about." Kathy Grace Duncan, a member of Changed, that's one of the organizations, who formally identified as a transgender man, told NBC News, quote, "They're asking for certain rights in this legislation, but these are rights that they already have." Okay. And then to further that, her colleague, Jim Doman, who's the founder of what they call Church United, and he identifies as formally gay, told NBC, "Sexual behavior should not be a protected right." Now, this is really important. Sexual behavior. The right-wing talking point has always been to classify, the LGBTQI community as a lifestyle or a behavior, okay, or as a mental illness if you're talking about the trans community. So they're fighting pieces of legislation, okay, that would essentially zero out that kind of opposition. Now, in many cases, especially with these ex-gay and ex-transgender folks, they are there and positioned as a direct result of what the religious right calls talk therapy, which the rest of us call conversion therapy or reparative therapy, which has been proven to be harmful, by the way, and has been banned in 18 states as well as the District of Columbia. This particular piece of legislation is to make it federal. In other words, broad stroke it across the United States to protect, especially the most vulnerable, which are LGBTQI youth. And I would say, as a result of this administration and the Christian right segueing into what we're about to talk to, particularly trans youth, who really do need to be protected. So
right.
That's also happening
right
on Capitol Hill today. And with that, I'll throw it back to you.
Yeah. Yeah, and Brody, that actually, I'm really glad you ended with that story because it kind of does juxtapose what the talking points around, as we described at the top of the show, this attack of transgender kids and their parents who want to be supportive and who are making moves to be supportive of their children. There's kind of a principle behind this of what is the parental authority that is available across the board? Because on the conversion therapy side, you have parents who think they're, and in your and my judgments, their ignorance should be respected, and that the fact that they're doing something that the medical establishment has said is truly dangerous to their children, they feel they have the right to impose it on those kids. And they're attacking the other side where, again, according to the medical authorities, parents of transgender kids who are supportive are actually in a process of life-saving affirmation for those kids. And they want to attack that those parents should not have the right to exercise that. And so I'm wondering how this will eventually play out, and will one of these situations affect the other? In other words, will a principle from what happens on one side of, what is appropriate for a parent to do with their child affect this other situation of other parents wanting to do something else with their children?
I think so. I just before we went on the air, I posted a statement that I received from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and this is kind of very important, and it's a real brief statement, but I'll read it. A Georgia state legislator recently shared plans to draft a bill that would make aiding gender transition of minors a felony. And the statement is from Southern Poverty Law Senior Staff Attorney Beth Littrell. I happen to know her, and here's Beth's reflections on that. State Representative Jenny Earhart's proposal reflects a stunning lack of knowledge coupled with an enormous amount of prejudice. Not only does it contradict the overwhelming medical consensus on treating gender dysphoria by professional medical organizations such as the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American Medical Association, among many others, but it also puts children at risk of irreparable harm. Now, I've spoken to two or three activists within the trans community about not only just this piece of proposed legislation, but also the situation on the ground in Texas. And it was pointed out to me that the entire toxicity and attitude behind all of this, including what Beth was talking about in her statement, there's a direct real-world impact on it, that this is going to create a state of, you know, depression and hopelessness among trans youth, and we could see an uptick of them killing themselves or being cast out of their homes, running away, homeless. So, yeah, there's real-world effects of this. So it's not just a partisan political issue. This is a very much a real-world issue, and the organizations that Beth quoted absolutely are opposed to this sort of thing. But I think it's also pretty dire when you have state lawmakers. And by the way, in the case in Texas, which we'll be talking about in a minute, there's proposed legislation that is at the behest, believe it or not, of that state's governor, that does essentially what the Georgia legislator is proposing, that would make gender transition, you know, a felony. So these people are doing a full court press, and they're basing a lot of it on pseudoscience and outright fabricated garbage that has been disproven by not only the professional medical community, the organizations that I just cited in her statement, but overall. And again, right now on Capitol Hill, we've got 15 or 16 people running around spreading even more of this, okay? And they're getting friendly ears, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle. So, yeah, there's some definite effects to this, Rob.
Right. No, that's part of what concerns me is that, and it goes back to what we were talking about the impeachment and the Republican Party, how PR and misstatements and characterizations are what are driving so much of this. Because the story that's being told, and first of all, most of what has been said about the particular case in Texas is completely false. This is not a woman trying to take a child away from their father and cut him out and turn their child into another gender and, you know, all the things that have been suggested. Also, the support the child is getting is not in the form of any radical medical either drugs or operations, which is also being implied. So for public figures to ignorantly and stupidly and with evil, yes, I'm talking about you, Ted Cruz, to characterize a mom in a way that even implies she's exercising child abuse is abhorrent. And they're going to be able to get away with it in certain factors because it's the image of, oh my goodness, there's this little boy whose mother wants to, you know, put breast implants on him and castrate him and do all these things. And that's the image that they are wanting to project forward. And when it is PR'd in that way, you know, people who don't really have the time of day that they want to give a lot of in-depth research or thought to are going to go just sort of gut reaction, go, oh, yeah, that sounds really bad. Oh, I'm against that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't help when you have people, you know, such as Senator Cruz. I mean, he tweeted that the jury's decision in favor of the mother was, and I'm quoting the senator, horrifying and tragic. Then he added, for a parent to subject such a young child to life-altering hormone blockers, to medically transition their sex is nothing less than child abuse. And then, of course, you know, the president's eldest son weighed in, tweeting, "This is child abuse. People need to stand up against this bullshit. Enough is enough." You know, and it's firing up their base. It's getting people angry. It was enough that even, you know, Republican Governor of Texas Greg Abbott ordered the Texas Attorney General's office and the state's Department of Family Protective Services to launch an investigation into the mother, okay, probing claims of child abuse against the child. Yeah, just absolutely on unfounded information. And again, because of allegations, you know, the Texas State Attorney General's chief assistant, Jeff Mateer, accused the mother of chemically and surgically altering the child's biological sex based on her belief that he may identify as a girl, which would lead to permanent and potentially irreversible harm. Well, you know, first of all, I need to note that this first AG in the Texas AG's department has got a long history of being a transphobe and a homophobe. So that's not all out of character for him, but it's that they're whipping up their base and they're whipping people up based on pseudoscience and complete misinformation. But they're walking a very dangerous path here because they're making it impossible for parents, quite frankly, to be parents and to be affirming. And this could lead, and you know, and this could literally lead into other areas that I think that a lot of people probably, you know, as you said, that, well, they hear the news and go, "I'm against that," but they don't understand the ramifications because it'll have carryover into other areas. And I think the other part of it that really, you know, is annoying is that, you know, most of it is based on misinformation. Gillian Brandstetter, who is the chief spokesperson for the National Center for Transgender Equality, told Rolling Stone magazine in a piece a couple days ago, and I'm quoting her, "The only reason this case is so high profile is thanks to an entire universe of websites and bloggers spreading disinformation about who trans people are and what it means to affirm and love a trans child and what trans healthcare entails," she continues. "I think it's been a growing problem bubbling just beneath the surface of mainstream political discourse, and it is deeply unfortunate that it has surfaced in this way." And, you know, this is one of those things where I think that we also, you know, we have a responsibility, obviously, in media to make sure that we're not spreading disinformation and that we're not spreading, you know, what basically amounts to, you know, pseudoscience and garbage. And at the end of the day, you know, these type of decisions, and this is now my own personal opinion, I think these type of decisions, especially when it comes down to the medical care of the child, should be between the parents and the primary care physicians, or and I will include the psychiatrists and psychologists in that. I think that having the state legislate that type of thing, especially be that, you know, invasive in a very, very personal way, it's just, it's wrong. That is literally government overreach at its worst, Rob.
Right. No, I understand and I agree with you. The place where I get conflicted is because when that same principle that you just described comes up against conversion therapy, the people on the other side would say, well, you know, we agree with you. You know, it should be between us, our private physician, and our child. And, you know, we don't want them to be gay. So, you know, we have a therapist, we have a physician who is backing us up, and we want to work to make the child heterosexual. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's, that's where I think, you know, we do need the medical establishment to be stronger on both of these, because that is the difference on this. One additional area that has nothing to do with gender or sexuality is mm-hmm. kind of the ADD, ADHD mm-hmm. situation where, and I have a child who I've been pressured for years to, or hinted at, pressured in a subtle way, but still there, because, you know, different school systems would find it easier to teach him if he was drugged. And I haven't been willing to do that because I have not been convinced that that was the healthiest thing for him individually because of the history he has, but just in general. And, so as these things get pushed outward to other authorities or other, you know, people, especially with political agendas, to make those decisions, that is disturbing. And I say that being fully against conversion therapy being put upon somebody under the age of 18 because of the catastrophic mental damage that that does to those kids. So it's getting grayer that I think are difficult.
Yeah. Well, and it is a very difficult thing. And again, your point is well taken. I think that the problem we run into here is that what they're trying to accomplish is not based on science. And, you know, when you look at the healthcare standard is in terms of looking at this, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics, you know, has advocated for clinicians and parents to embrace gender affirming approaches to transgender and gender nonconforming kids, and have also done the same thing conversely for gay, queer, and non-binary. So there are some, you know, medical doctors that are stepping up and saying, yes, we really need to be more affirming of this, and we really need to take more direct action on this. And I think that that's going to be one of the things that is important. But, you know, it's as the late Joseph Heller wrote so famously in his book, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, in some cases, also known as Catch 22. And I think that this is something, you know, based on, you know, what you just said, and I'm not disputing it, but I think it does become a legislative Catch 22, because if you attack one issue one way and you don't attack the issue the other way, then you're left there. However, I still personally am just opposed to governmental overreach into areas such as this, that it should be up to the parents, but, you know, within reason and within medical parameters and aspects of care that would be non-harming. So I think that's my caveat to, you know, where it should go.
Right. No, and I agree. And I think there is this, we need and like I said, I think the medical establishment needs to step forward and take a much more aggressive tone in both these areas, so that they're established on what, you know, the appropriate public health standard is on this and needs to be, because that's where the question comes down and that's where the differentiator comes down. I mean, we've seen this in areas where people have tried to elect through their own belief systems and moral compasses and everything else in terms of medical care itself, where you know, there's a religious freedom and there are people who believe in faith healing, but if they don't take their child to a medical practitioner when that child is physically ill, they do not get to impose their belief system on a situation that medical science can step in and save a life.
And I think that this is something, but we also need to look too at an aspect that sometimes gets overlooked. But, you know, these parents now are under fire. Barnstetter at the National Trans Equality Center noted to the Rolling Stone, she's spoken to parents of transgender kids in Texas, and now they're at the point where they're terrified of speaking out at all because their governor is sitting there threatening, you know, an investigation and a child abuse, unleashing, you know, Child Protective Services. And there's been a history, and not a good one, of Child Protective Service investigations that just quite frankly have not ended well, even if nothing had occurred at all whatsoever. They take on a life of their own, and they become completely damaging. In many cases, intentional or not, a CPS investigation can literally end up destroying a family. And for these trans parents, that's something, you know, they don't want to put themselves or their trans kids through. And I don't quite frankly blame them.
No, yeah, so. I agree. And it, you know, and it just how you described the legislation that's proposed and the scrutiny and those things that are happening, it reminded me in a lot of ways of the situation in Russia where they were, you know, putting, you know, laws against, quote unquote, promoting the LGBTQ lifestyle, you know, which could be just advocating for it. Or, you know, it's like it was this sort of catch-all bucket that allowed for all sorts of oppressive action. And that does sound like what is being set up here. So
absolutely. I think that the one thing that we need to note on this, and Barnstetter said it to Rolling Stone, and I'm going to reiterate it because this is something that I know even from the conversations you and I have had previously with some trans folks of note and allies who've been on our program. But in light of ample research, which suggests that affirming a child's gender identity has a positive impact on their physical and mental health, you know, implications of legislation, which you and I just discussed, are nothing short of terrifying, she said. And I'll continue. Such a bill, if proposed, and especially signed into law, would have a body count. It would not only destroy lives, but end lives. It is absurdly dangerous, and it is an extreme proposal beyond any recognition of reality. And that's absolutely the truth, Rob. And the thing is, I think it's really important that the allies and people that are supportive of the LGBTQI community, this is the time more than ever we need their help, because we need them to stand up. We need to knock the pseudoscience down. We need to knock this religious crap down. You know, this isn't about the Bible. This isn't about biblical anything. This is about people's lives. This is about something that is rooted in science and biology, and it is not appropriate to try and legislate it, nor is it appropriate to sit there and condemn it.
Right. And I think on all these issues, we need the strength of education. We need the strength of medical authority. We need the understanding to be the guiding principle in the public and not rely on courts and legislatures to carry us through. And I mean this both in the conversion therapy side as well as, protection of trans families, because it is both cases, the practice is devastating to the child. The conversion therapy is devastating to the children that are forced through it, and the lack of support for transgender kids is devastating on the other side. And the welfare of the children should be the top priority. And if we look to courts to try to balance those issues out, we're going to get into people who are philosophically detrimental to it and have agendas, and I think some families will get caught in the crosshairs, and more importantly, some children's lives will get caught in the crosshairs, and that would be horrendous. So, Brody, as we are going to end our show a little bit early today, so this is going to be a little shorter podcast than folks may be used to. I certainly encourage our listeners to continue listening and pick out another podcast of ours to continue on. I think they're all fascinating and intriguing, and I would encourage that greatly. Any final thoughts from you on today?
I think that we need to be very, very careful moving forward. We need to start having more of an engagement, as I said, in the public about these type of issues. For our listeners that are interested, Rolling Stone magazine has a very fine article on this. It's entitled "How a Texas Custody Case Became a Terrifying Right-Wing Talking Point." The reporter is E.J. Dickinson, and it was published on October 28 online at rollingstone.com. And I really, really, really am going to beseech you to please go read this piece and to get a real good understanding of what these issues are and how these really do actually have such a negative impact, particularly on the most vulnerable, which, of course, are our trans and our LGBT queer youth. So, and with that, Rob, I will wish you a happy Halloween, and I will wish our listeners a happy Halloween. Another reminder, if you see a blue bucket out there, would you please be kind? That's an autistic child, and I personally would thank you for you being extra special nice to them. And with that, Rob, I throw it at you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brody. I really appreciate all your help and input and participation today. I thank our listeners for tuning in. We appreciate that very much. Also, don't forget, out in Santa Cruz on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time, you can hear that on www.ksco.com. And there is a KSCO app that you can download and listen to that show via that app as well. It is not available, unfortunately, on the podcast apps, which this show is available. And please do encourage your friends, family, and everybody you know to click on our podcast on their podcast app and subscribe. We welcome them with open arms and open ears. And so for Brody and myself, we'll be back again next week, same bat time, same bat channel. Can't wait to talk to you, and hope you have a happy holiday season as it is just getting started.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.